Support for Iditapod, a production of Alaska Public Media, comes from MVFCU. Experience the MVFCU way.
And it really just blew out into the open, and all that dirty laundry just got blown out into the street.
More drama off the race trail, but first...
1, 2, 3, 4!
Welcome to the Iditapod, a podcast about, what else, the Iditarod, which is supposed to be about dog mushing. We are a production of Alaska Public Media and KNOM in Nome. I'm your host, Casey Grove. Before we get into today's podcast, here's a word from our sponsor.
Support for Iditapod 2018 comes from Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, taking pride in its strong ties to Alaska's communities.
So we are into the fourth day of Iditarod sled dog teams mushing on the trail, and I feel like a lot has happened since yesterday's Iditapod episode. Some of it happened right after the episode went out. With the race well underway, some of the drama, we'll call it the next chapter in a reignited dog doping scandal, a confrontation, more accusations, that didn't even happen on the trail. And we'll get to that in a couple minutes. And a couple minutes after yesterday's pod dropped, I think I said it somewhere in there that there had been only one scratch. We got word that there had been another. And it's a big one. Didi Jonro. Didi is an icon and a favorite of many Iditarod fans, both young and old. She's known for her pink gear, sled bag, dog booties, even her dog truck is pink. And she was running her 36th Iditarod. The sad thing for a lot of people hearing about her scratch yesterday is that Didi had said this Iditarod would be her last. She pulled out at the Rainy Pass checkpoint a little after 11 a.m. yesterday. According to a statement from the Iditarod, Jonro made the decision to scratch for, quote, personal health reasons and concern for taking care of her dog team, which is her number one priority. I saw it reported elsewhere that Didi was experiencing flu-like symptoms and didn't want to continue on in case things got worse and she had to get rescued. In true Didi fashion, it sounded like she was mostly concerned about the dogs and whether she'd be able to take good enough care of them if she got sicker. Many people know this already, but it bears repeating. Didi is a cancer survivor and she's competed in the Iditarod through thick and thin, including after her parents died. She also raced the 2003 Iditarod just weeks after chemotherapy for breast cancer. And she and her husband, Mike, they lost their home in the 2015 Sockeye fire, and they even rescued a bunch of dogs from that fire that were racing in her team this year. She talked about that and how this final Iditarod was going to be an emotional one for her. We have an interview with her from the ceremonial start Saturday in Anchorage in episode 4. You can go back and take a listen to that. Didi hadn't really been running at the front of the pack in the last several years, but she finished the race in 10th in both 2012 and 2013, and her Iditarod record includes a total of 16 top 10 showings. That includes a string of top 10 finishes from 1988 to 1998, as well as 2 second place finishes in there. And, you know, sometimes when athletes say they're retiring, they don't, but Didi has sounded pretty serious about that, and this really might be the last time we've seen her mush in the Iditarod. In any case, we hope she and the dogs have a safe time getting off the trail and that she's feeling healthy again soon. So, yesterday, the teams were spread out between Rainy Pass and Nikolai. Today, as I'm recording this Wednesday morning, all but a few had made it to Nikolai and were on the way to McGrath with the leader, at last check, your Leifseth Olsom, all the way past Takotna and Ophir, more than 150 miles ahead of the teams at the back. Teams at the back of the pack are Tara Ciccatello and Steve Watkins, who I sold a duffel bag to once at a garage sale. Another probably more notable side note, if you're looking at the Iditarod's GPS tracker and seeing Ramey Smith at the very back of the pack thinking that can't possibly be true, you're right. Ramey is checked in to Takotna. His tracker hasn't updated for more than a day, and it's likely that the little tracker device is either malfunctioning or fell off or something. That happens sometimes. At the front, defending champ Mitch Seavey led all the way from Nikolai to Takotna, where he declared that he would take his mandatory 24-hour layover. But, like I said, the Norwegian Jor Olsom has been running out front since the wee hours this morning. That's because he stayed only 5 minutes in Takotna. Olsom continued mushing on to reach the next checkpoint of Ophir a little before 5 a.m. today, also staying there for only about 10 minutes, long enough to grab some supplies and keep going. The last I saw, it looked like he was resting outside of Ophir and just looking at his run rest schedule so far, probably camping out for a couple hours, just guessing. So he is, for now, in the lead after leaving behind five other front-of-the-pack sled dog teams in Takotna. That includes Seavey, Ray Reddington Jr., Jesse Royer, Linwood Fiedler, and Ali Zirkel. Seavey, again, is taking his 24-hour rest in Takotna, as he often does. He arrived there under light snow to find a small crowd gathered next to a fire.
I'd like to stay.
Same.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mitch, what's your bib number?
13. And I have 13 dogs.
Okay.
Seavey is still definitely well-positioned in the race, but he's had to adjust his plans a little bit, dealing with a lot of fresh snow, like everybody, which is causing a slower trail. A few checkpoints earlier, Seavey had switched over to runner plastic that is extra wide at the front of the sled, which helps float the weight and keeps the runners from punching through. That runner plastic, they pack that often in their drop bags, something that they will replace throughout the race. It just goes on the bottom of the runners. It's plastic, and that's what the entire sled slides on. So Seavey had switched out his old runner plastic, got some new runner plastic. He also apparently had to scrap his technique of carrying dogs inside his sled, rotating them between runs and rest.
It's too slow and soft this year. Well, it worked at first. I used it for a while. But I gave up on it because my dogs were working too hard. I hurt two dogs' back legs, I think, because of it.
He will no doubt be enjoying some pie in Takotna, among other excellent food items in that tiny community of about 50 people. I have fond memories from being there in 2014. The food was delicious. So some mushers decide to 24 in Takotna. It's a good spot to do it. And some are making the decision, not maybe according to their plan, to do it in McGrath. That's about 20 trail miles before Takotna, and they're having to make adjustments due to those soft trail conditions. Among those making the decision to 24 in McGrath was Wasilla musher Ryan Reddington.
I didn't want a 24 here, but the trail has been soft, so I'm going to 24 here and just try to recoup. Hopefully the trail will set up.
Reddington came in behind Girdwood musher Nicholas Petit and Wade Mars of Willow, who we will talk about here shortly. Reddington did lead Gnome's Aaron Burmeister into McGrath, where he and the rest of them all declared that they would take their 24-hour layovers. Though they are not obligated to stay for a full day, Burmeister said that the snow had forced his hand.
I originally planned to camp halfway from Nicolai to McGrath on the trail and go through McGrath to Ophir, but once I got out there and saw how deep the snow was, and it wasn't packing, and that if I did camp and 20 teams passed me while I was camping, the trail would probably fall apart further. I figured it'd be smart to come straight directly to McGrath and take a break here.
And there is more snow in the forecast for tonight. We'll see if that continues to affect the team's speeds, which affects their run times, and timing is the topic of today's question. Okay, that was a little bit of a reach, but I have to segue somehow, right? And this is a good question for right now. It comes to us from Michelle in Baltimore. She writes, "Hello, I'm a newbie to following the Iditarod. Hi, Michelle." And she continues, "Can you explain about the time differential and when we will know who is really in the lead in the standings and not just in first position in the race?" And there's an asterisk. It says, "Asterisk, unless this is an embarrassingly simple question that I should be able to find the answer to online." Thanks for the great question, Michelle. And it's not embarrassingly simple. And it's actually something that I've been hoping to get to here on the podcast. What she's referring to is that when the mushers left Willow on Sunday, they went out every 2 minutes. So, of course, if you were the last musher to leave, you were something like 2 hours behind the first musher. And they do that, unlike some other races, because if they started all the teams at once, it would just be complete mayhem. They need to have a chute to send them out, and they don't want the teams to get tangled up. So they send them out every 2 minutes. But then, of course, how do you adjust for that time? Well, what they do is they adjust those 24-hour layover times. And I'm just going to read from the Iditarod's rules here. The starting differential will be adjusted during each team's 24-hour stop. It is the musher's responsibility to remain for the entire 24-hour period plus starting differential. The ITC, that's the Iditarod Trail Committee, will give each musher the required time information prior to leaving the starting line. So let's just say that there were 60 teams in this race, which there are more than that, but just for the sake of this, we'll say there are 60. If you were the musher who left Willow first, that was Cody Straith, then you have to wait another 2 hours before you can leave after you're 24. You have to wait a full 26 hours. And that is to make up the difference between the folks that leave earlier in the race and the folks that leave later in the race. And of course, those adjustments are different for everybody. So if you're musher 60 out of 60 to leave Willow, you just take a 24-hour rest. Again, people take their 24s at different places, but once everybody has taken their 24, and once that adjustment has been made, they're essentially all on the exact same race clock, and that's when you kind of know who's really in the lead. Another thing to think about here, and because you asked about knowing who really is in the lead, is when they are resting and when they're running, and this will be a little bit more important toward the end of the race if you're really eager to track this, but teams run on different run rest schedules. Sometimes it's like a 2-to-1 ratio, 1 hour of rest, 2 hours of running. In the past, people had done 1-to-1. But if you're kind of looking at that analytics and you have access to that information, what you'll be looking at is when a musher might take a rest stop out on the trail. Sometimes they just camp out for several hours. And that's just all part of mushing. It's a form of wilderness travel. So they will pull off the trail and camp out. They'll take straw with them for the dogs and food from their drop bags. And if you're tracking kind of when a musher is running and resting, you can see as they leapfrog each other down the trail where they might be, and you can kind of start to predict who's really in the lead or who's going to be in the lead at a certain point. So, good question. I hope I answered that fully. And well, now it's time to answer another question that you all might be asking after I've alluded to it a couple times. We have some more drama, some more controversy. So I'm just going to try to lay this all out in order. Last fall, the Iditarod said that dogs on one of the mushers' teams had tested positive for a banned substance. Later, it came out that that was Dallas Seavey's team, the former champion. He was angry that they had released his name. He denies ever giving anything to his dogs and actually hired a lawyer. And through that process, the lawyer dealing with the Iditarod, they got the toxicology reports, and there was a mention in there of another musher's team being flagged for some kind of banned substance. And the more recent reporting is that that was just an initial test, that it just found tiny, tiny amounts of something that might relate to a banned substance, and that the Iditarod in the end determined that it was not actually a positive drug test. And this is all coming to light now while the race is going on, because apparently on Sunday, right before starting in Willow, Wade Mars had a conversation with the head toxicologist for the Iditarod, Maury Craig. Wade describes that in a press release from his kennel on his behalf as being intimidating, that Dr. Craig had threatened him and told him to back off of his support of Dallas. Craig has a different version of events. There's been some really good reporting by Kyle Hopkins at the Anchorage Daily News on this, and I sat down with him to talk about this new revelation, this reignition of the dog doping issue. This continuing controversy, it's got different layers now. And the next layer, it sounds like, is related to Wade Mars. And if you could just kind of give me the general rundown on this recent news.
To summarize the news that broke today, we had been talking to the head of the Iditarod dog drug testing program. This is the founder of the program, who apparently kind of wrote the book literally on drug testing for dogs in Iditarod, because he's this longtime toxicology veterinarian professor from Oregon. So we had been talking to him for a couple of days because we'd heard that there was an encounter that he had with a musher right before the race restart in Willow, where words were exchanged and the musher felt as if he had been threatened. He felt intimidated by something that this kind of not chief veterinarian, but the person who actually runs the testing program had said to him. And of course, the context and the weight of that conversation would be, you know, this is the person who wrote who handled the reports on Dallas Seavey's dogs and was at the heart of the controversy that Dallas Seavey brought to light over the last 6 months and has been at the center of kind of all this heartache within the Iditarod and the drug testing scandal and the accusations of drug doping. So it's a continuation of that problem and one that we didn't expect, and I think no one kind of expected to continue. This was supposed to be a time of do the race, get the race over with, and then look at how to change that process or what was wrong with it. And instead, you have this revelation that, oh, here's a brand new, you know, scandal, if you will, that one of the top mushers, and importantly, the head of the finishers club, so like the president of the union of mushers, saying, hey, I had a really nasty conversation, kind of a spooky conversation with the head of this testing program from his point of view. And then the conversation we were having with the drug testing director was that he felt that his intentions and his words maybe were misinterpreted, and he denies that he was trying to threaten or intimidate the musher.
Was there a tip that this exchange had happened, but you didn't know who the musher was?
The reporting began with, we had heard that this encounter happened, that there was an encounter between the drug testing director and a musher, and I didn't know which musher, right before the race started, like about half an hour before the race started. And so the first call was to Iditarod, and that didn't get me anywhere. And so the second call was just to the cell phone of the drug testing director, and he's the first one who said Wade Mars's name, which has become kind of part of the story, because the concern from Mars's kennel is that he shouldn't have, you know, revealed which musher he was talking about in that conversation.
And then kind of what happened after that? It sounds like there was more information that came from Wade.
Right. So we had the initial conversation with the Iditarod drug testing director. Didn't publish a story. We were looking to get more information. I asked for information from Iditarod, asked for information from Wade's kennel. They didn't want to talk. They kind of wanted to wait and see what Iditarod did. I talked to the toxicology professor, the Iditarod drug guy, again, and just got a better sense of the timeline. And at that point, he told me a couple times that this was an issue that Iditarod was looking into. He didn't feel like he did anything wrong, except he did want to apologize to Wade, and he did think that he probably should not have had that conversation at that time, because it's just a bad time to be kind of dropping a lot, you know, some highly charged information on the musher right before they're about to step on the runners and start their race. So at that point, I felt like we probably had a story that we could report, and we gave, you know, they did a ton to respond. They didn't really. And then eventually, when we finally pulled the trigger on the story, was when someone from Wade's kennel, his girlfriend, sent out this statement on his behalf that swung pretty hard at Iditarod, saying that they felt this was totally unprofessional. They felt like it was a threat. They felt like it was intentional intimidation. The part that was new that came from the Wade's kennel was where they were directly accusing Maury Craig of threatening them, of saying, in their words, you know, kind of back off of this activity with the Finishers Club and on behalf of Dallas Seavey, who the Iditarod is feuding with, then Craig would release information about drug tests involving Wade's own team to the public. And so that was their accusation. And to be clear, Craig says that is not the case at all. He says he never made any kind of quid pro quo threat of that kind at all. He says the only thing that he talked about in terms of revealing something publicly was that he told Wade, and he told me this as well, that he had planned and there was some agreement that they would talk about the 2017 drug test results in some detail after the race. And so unclear, only two people were involved in that conversation. And so we don't know exactly what was said, but, you know, very different interpretations and portrayals of that conversation. The way this relates to the Dallas Seavey issue, where Seavey skipped the race because he was angry with the way that the Iditarod handled the news, the findings that four of his dogs had tested positive. The way it relates to that is Seavey, when he's doing his investigation, he gets paperwork from Iditarod. The way that he saw it pointed towards a potential second musher who had a positive result. And the Iditarod has said that that's not the case, that there wasn't another positive result, that the way that the testing process works is you have, you know, there's a first screening and that casts a wide net and you're looking at many different types of drugs. And so they flagged Seavey's team and they flagged another team, Team 17, which was, no one knew who that was at the time. And Seavey took that to be another, he figured that was another potential positive test for drug testing. The Iditarod said, no, what we found, we flagged it the first time, we did a second more thorough screening, and what we found was there was a minuscule amount, trace elements, nanograms of this drug that sometimes
can be found in meat because it's administered to livestock for like low grade quality meat. That meat then makes its way into dog food or dog bowls. They're eaten by the dogs, but it's in such a small amount that it would never affect performance. So it's a type of drug that would be banned if there was a lot of it, but there was a tiny amount of it that probably just meant the dogs ate it because some cow ate it. So they don't consider that a positive test. And that's where there's lots of confusion, and that's where the concern is that, you know, and we were also concerned about this because we didn't want readers to think that Wade had a positive drug test result, because no one is saying that. But there had been a lot of questions about who was this other musher? What was this other team? And so the director of the drug program says that he's having this conversation with Wade. Wade's about to race the Iditarod. He approaches Wade. They talk about it. Wade asks, who was the other musher? And the director of the program says, well, it was you. And apparently Wade had never been told that before. So that was kind of like this bombshell that gets dropped on him, you know, at the 11th hour.
So he finds out right before he's about to take off on the race, they put out this statement. Did they say more about, I guess, what the conversation was like? It sounds like the drug tester toxicologist was at least according to Stump Jumping Kennels, Wade's kennel, they were threatening him?
That's what Wade's kennel says, that they perceived it to be a threat. And the doctor, the toxicology professor, he says that all he did was answer Wade's question and talk about the facts of the drug testing. And so in terms of, you know, what makes that a threat or what makes that intimidation, certainly the notion that that was revealed to the musher at the time and place that it was revealed, that raises questions. And the Iditarod said that at best that was ill-timed, that conversation. The director of the drug program says, hey, I probably shouldn't have had that conversation at that time. You know, was it intentional intimidation? Was it a threat? That's where there's a difference of opinion. And I haven't talked to Wade's kennel about what was said. I've only talked to the doctor. You know, the race is struggling to get back on track, and the drug testing process has been a real source of heartache now for months and cost them their Michael Jordan, you know, in Dallas Seavey, who skipped the race because he was so angry at how that was handled. And so now to have kind of another top-tier musher, another up-and-comer musher, this young musher who potentially could win the Iditarod and certainly speaks for his fellow mushers as the president of this, you know, union, so to speak, to have him say, look, the person running this process has problems, has ethical problems, is saying things he shouldn't be saying, is doing things he shouldn't be doing, is acting unprofessional. It just is another black eye to the Iditarod at a time when they're really looking to turn things around and reassure everyone that the race is in good hands and is about to get back on track.
And Maury Craig has some other skeletons in his closet. What are those?
Maury Craig has a Google problem, certainly. You know, anyone who is unfamiliar with who he is, if they're looking him up, what they're going to find, you know, a few years ago, they would have found that this is this veteran toxicologist who, you know, is involved in lots of efforts to learn about, you know, how drugs affect animals or, you know, are, you know, manifest themselves in animals and in testing. What they would find if they looked at Maury Craig right now is that in late October, he was fired from his job with Oregon State University. That he was fired because the university found that he had potentially committed sexual harassment and bullying of students. He says that's not true. He told me that's not true. He said it's related to his role as a landlord, that a student or multiple students rented and there was some kind of dispute. He's fighting it. He's trying to keep his job, but he actually apparently has been banned from campus at this moment. So he's still employed by the university, but he's really under a cloud back in Oregon.
Have you ever seen as much controversy around the race? It feels like that is sort of the story of this year's Iditarod.
I think the story of this year's Iditarod is that the race is tearing itself apart from the inside a little bit in a way that I hadn't seen before. It's always under attack to some degree from outsiders. And the strength of that community often is, you know, they band together. They feel like if they can tell their story, if they can show people how they feel about the sport and about the dogs, that
there's power kind of in the unity of the mushing community. And while there's always mushers who are unhappy with some of the board members or unhappy with some of the policies, you know, they're kind of cranky people sometimes. they can be kind of a cranky tribe of people, but usually there's at least some unity in that they're all coming together in defense of their sport. And now you have, it just feels like there's a fissure within the sport itself. You have Dallas skipping the race. You have people calling for, you know, to kind of cut off the head of the organization and replace it. And that stuff never came up before in the open. Maybe it was all happening behind closed doors before, but it never kind of spilled out into the street the way we've seen it this year.
That's Anchorage Daily News reporter Kyle Hopkins explaining the latest in Iditarod dog doping drama. And that's all the time we have for drama today on the Iditapod. We're going to send it out on some upbeat music, as usual. We are in the midst of our daily episodes. Please check back tomorrow for the next installment. You can find us on iTunes and other podcatcher apps or listen online at alaskapublic.org. Our theme music is by the band Sassafras. I'm Casey Grove. Until next time, happy, maybe happier trails.
Testing 1, 2, 1, 2, rocking the mic with MC K Hop and some donuts, sugar donuts. I feel like this must be somebody's actual office that there's donuts here. okay, so here's the part where I stick the microphone in your face.